We have with us our brother Jim Cowie, and his topic for this class is Watchmen, What of the Night, Britain, Europe, and the Papacy.
Well, thank you, Brother James, and good morning, brethren and sisters and young people and Sunday school scholars. Well, it's an unusual Sunday school, isn't it? Because you normally start with a hymn and all the other things that you normally do. But I've suggested that maybe a few more minutes might be gained by just starting straight up without a reading, etc. And that way I probably will get through what we have to deal with this morning before I have to sit down prior to 11 a.m. So we're going to deal with some very interesting things today. And in fact, for about 11 minutes, I'm going to sit down and let you watch a video. So you might get a few laughs out of that. You know, when David was made king, there was a class of people in Israel, it says in 1 Chronicles 12:32, that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. And of course, the question is, will that be so just before Christ comes to be made king? Well, let's hope so. Let's hope there is a group of people who will know their Bible sufficiently well, who will know their prophecy so that they see the hand of God at work and know that the day is at hand when they will make their appearance before the judge. All the signs are converging. The world, of course, as you probably are aware, is teetering on the verge of an economic collapse that it has never seen in its history. All that's required now is angelic manipulation to push the house of cards over. You know, one puff of breeze and the whole thing will go over the edge. And I can show you a lot of evidence that that is soon to happen. When that will happen, nobody can tell. Whether it's this year or next year, we don't know. But it's very, very close. And there are many who think it may well be this year. So we'll have to wait and see on that. But the important thing is that we know the times in which we live and that we are able to do what the Lord said we should do. What I say unto you, he said to his disciples, I say unto all, whether they be in his generation or ours, watch. We do need to be watching and to know what is happening around us. Now, we're going to try and deal with these subjects this morning. We're going to have a look at Britain, which is taking steps that will see it leave the European Union prior to Armageddon, and that's required by prophecy. We'll have a look at the young lions and who they are, the prospects of a black pope. We'll have a look at the papacy mingling itself with the seed of men. We'll have a look at Europe rebuilding the Holy Roman Empire, that is the Fourth Reich. And we'll have a look, hopefully, if time permits, at 2060 as the end of the papal system and the political system that supports it, though not necessarily of all its adherents. And we'll come to that in due course. And about 20-odd years ago, I heard someone say from the platform that Britain, which was always an essential part of the Roman Empire, was part of Nebuchadnezzar's image. Well, of course, I knew that wasn't right. But I wanted proof that that wasn't right. So I went looking for that proof. And I think it's helpful to know how things panned out in history. Now, we're familiar with Nebuchadnezzar's image, of course. We know that there are two legs, and we've got the feet shown here. We've got one leg, the papacy in Rome, which represents, of course, Babylon the Great in the west. And we have the power of Gog installed in Constantinople, becomes the king of the north when it takes the area from Syria to Pakistan, and the little horn of the goat when it's finally in Constantinople. Well, in 420 AD, the Roman Empire was finally resolved into two legs, with an emperor in Rome and Constantinople. Now, it had gone through many iterations in its history. There were times when the Roman Empire had four parts and three parts, and there were other things that happened. But it was not until 420 AD that the two legs were formed. Well, the Romans had left Britain in 410 AD. So when the legs were formed, Britain was no longer part of the Roman Empire. The Romans were gone. And I think that's very, very important to recognise, because Britain is not part of Nebuchadnezzar's image and will not be part of it in the great day when, of course, Christ destroys it. Now, the feet of that image with its 10 toes is a confederation of European states united for a time by Gog. It's a brittle fusion of democracy and false religion. We're going to talk a little bit about that in a moment. But just a point in regard to the 10 toes. Now, I'm often asked, Well, you know, there are 27 nations in the European Union, and you're saying there's going to be 10 nations who support the papacy and are in league with Gog. Well, yes, brethren and sisters, I don't think there's any doubt there are going to be 10 European nations. You know how that's going to happen? When the Great Depression hits, the southern European nations, most of whom are bankrupt, who are now being supported by the richer, wealthier northern European nations, they're going to be hived off, because Germany and Finland and Sweden and all the other countries that are now supporting them through their taxpayers are going to say, enough is enough. You can go down the gurgler, but we're not going down with you. And what will happen is that you'll have the southern European nations forming into 10 states. They will be underwritten by the papacy. They'll need the papal support. And the Pope is going to acquire immense power in southern Europe. You know what we're going to have? We're going to have the old Roman Empire reformed. It will go up to the Rhine, all right? And the nations above will be no longer part of it. That's what we're going to get. And there will be 10 left. Now, there may be some amalgamation of nations, you know, like the little countries that don't really matter. They may amalgamate, but we'll have 10. There's absolutely no question about that. So we're going to talk about a few of these things this morning. So the end of Roman rule in Britain is shown by this chart, this map. The end of Roman rule, it actually steps through the dates. You may not be able to read all of those, but final departure of the west and north in 383, coming down here to the time when the Romans were gone, out of Britain. Now, Britain is clearly the Tarshish of Ezekiel 38 and verse 13, proven by scripture, by history, and by strolling around Cornwall, which I've done, where you find, you know, Phoenician wells that are built, totally different. I think the Phoenicians built round wells. Anyway, the British did one and the Phoenicians did another. There are square wells and round wells. So you know the Phoenicians were strongly ensconced in the south of Britain. Britain with its young lions will oppose Gog's invasion of the land, of course. And that means that Britain, when it finally leaves the European Union, will need to rebuild its relationship with its former colonies. Now, I normally say something about America not being one of those, but I'm going to leave that out today because I don't want to offend anybody before I get kicked out of this place. So we'll leave the matter of America not being a young lion alone. But Britain is now part of the EU and has been so since 1968. And it doesn't matter what side of politics. It was a Conservative government led by Edward Heath that took Britain into the European Union. Today there is a Conservative government led by David Cameron. And he continues to be a strong supporter of Britain remaining in Europe. Well, how was God going to overcome this? It's gone on now for, you know, 40 years. How was God going to overcome that? Well, he does, of course, brilliantly in choosing men to fulfil his purpose. Britain, however, has strenuously refused to use the euro as its currency, and it retained the pound. And this current Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron, though a strong supporter of continued membership, has a problem. And the problem is that the British public has different ideas about remaining in Europe. And when they take a poll now of British citizens, about 70% of them say, we want to get out of Europe. And there's been pressure for a long time to have a referendum. Well, of course, Cameron has been putting it off and off and off because he knows he's going to lose it. Whenever it's held, he's going to lose it. And he's been forced now to agree to it. But they're pushing it off beyond the next election and they want to hold it in 2017. So how has this situation changed? How is it that the bulk of British citizens today want to be out of Europe? What has changed public opinion? Well, an instrument of God. So I'm going to show you now an 11-minute video. Some of you will have seen parts of this before, but you'll get a bit of a laugh out of this too. I enjoy this because it's terrific, isn't it, to be able to see Bible prophecy being fulfilled and laugh at the same time. And we're going to do that here this morning. So I'm going to sit down, I'm going to show you this movie. Now what you need to do is to read the screen carefully because you're going to get some music first, but if you read what's on the screen, it'll reinforce what I'm now going to say. The man you're going to see talking is Nigel Farage. He is the leader of the UKIP party, the United Kingdom Independence Party, which was formed in the late 1990s to elect or try and get elected members for the European Parliament. We're not talking about the British Parliament, which meets in London in the House of Commons. We're talking about the European Parliament, which meets in Brussels, but once a month goes and meets in Strasbourg, where they built that monstrosity based upon the Tower of Babel. Yeah, they built a parliamentary, it looks like the Tower of Babel, deliberately, because they're actually rebuilding the Tower of Babel in Europe. Well, they go and meet at Strasbourg at times. So you've got to see that this video has meetings in both places. Now, this gentleman, Farage, was elected in 1999. He's been elected with bigger majorities at every election since. He now has four or five additional members of his party. His party, which was a non-entity 10 years ago in Britain, is now winning by-elections against both major parties. This is in Britain. They're getting seats in the House of Commons in Britain, and David Cameron is a very worried man. And I spoke to an English brother who was at the Bible school at Rathmines just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he said to me, Cameron's got a problem. This guy is going to make life very hard for him. Well, he's made life pretty hard for quite a few European politicians, and especially the leaders of the European Union. So let's have a listen.
Mr. Nigel Farage, President of the Europe of Freedom and Democracy.
Look, when we had a president, we'd see a giant global political figure. The man that would be the political leader for 500 million people. The man that would represent all of us on the world stage. The man whose job was so important that, of course, you're paid more than President Obama. Well, I'm afraid what we got was you. And I'm sorry, but after that performance earlier that you gave, and I don't want to be rude, but you know, really, you have the charisma of a damp rag and the appearance of a low-grade bank clerk. And the question that I want to ask, that we're all going to ask, is who are you? I've never heard of you. Nobody in Europe had ever heard of you. I would like to ask you, President, who voted for you? And what mechanism? Oh, I know democracy is not popular with you lot. And what mechanism do the peoples of Europe have to remove you? Is this European democracy? Well, I sense, though, that you're competent and capable and dangerous. And I have no doubt that it's your intention to be the quiet assassin of European democracy and of the European nation states. You appear to have a loathing for the very concept of the existence of nation states. Perhaps that's because you come from Belgium, which of course is pretty much a non-country. But since you took over, we've seen Greece reduced to nothing more than a protectorate. Sir, you have no legitimacy in this job at all, and I can say with confidence that I can speak on behalf of the majority of the British people in saying, we don't know you, we don't want you, and the sooner you're put out to grass, the better.
Thank you.
Group. Mr. Farage.
Another one bites the dust. Country number four, Spain, gets bailed out, and we all, of course, know that it won't be the last. Though I wondered over the weekend whether perhaps I was missing something, because when the Spanish Prime Minister, Mr. Rajoy, got up, he said that this bailout shows what a success the Eurozone has been. And I thought, well, having listened to him over the previous couple of weeks telling us there wouldn't be a bailout, I've got the feeling, after all his twists and turns, he's just about the most incompetent leader in the whole of Europe. And that's saying something, because there's pretty stiff competition. Every prediction of yours, Mr. Barroso, has been wrong. And dear old Herman Van Rompuy, well, he's done a runner, hasn't he? Because the last time he was here, he told us we'd turn the corner, that the Euro crisis was over, and he hasn't bothered to come back and see us. You know, I remember being here 10 years ago and hearing the launch of the Lisbon Agenda. We were told that with the Euro, by 2010, we would have full employment, and indeed that Europe would be the competitive and dynamic powerhouse of the world. By any objective criteria, the Euro has failed, and in fact there is a looming, impending disaster. You know, this deal makes things worse, not better. 100 billion is put up for the Spanish banking system, and 20% of that money has to come from Italy. And under the deal, the Italians have to lend to the Spanish banks at 3%, but to get that money, they have to borrow on the markets at 7%. It's genius, isn't it? It really is brilliant. So what we're doing with this package is we're actually driving countries like Italy towards needing to be bailed out themselves. In addition to that, we put a further 10% on Spanish national debt. And I tell you, any banking analyst will tell you 100 billion doesn't solve the Spanish problem. It would need to be more like 400 billion. And with Greece teetering on the edge of Euro withdrawal, the real elephant in the room is that once Greece leaves, the ECB, the European Central Bank, is bust. It's gone. It has 444 billion euros worth of exposure to the bailed out countries. And to rectify that, you'll need to have a cash call from Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Greece and Italy. You couldn't make it up, could you? It is total and utter failure. This ship, the Euro Titanic, has now hit the iceberg, and sadly, there simply aren't enough lifeboats.
The group, Monsieur Farage.
Thank you. I want to begin today on a happy note to remember that it is 20 years ago this very week that the United Kingdom, having been signed up by the Conservative government to the exchange rate mechanism, broke out of the exchange rate mechanism. It was a great liberation for us, and of course, once having been bitten, we didn't join the Euro project, thank goodness. Sadly, the same is not true for much of the rest of Europe. And I thought, through the last 18 months or so, that the economic logic of why Britain left the ERM would apply, particularly to those Mediterranean countries, and I foresaw that actually those countries would leave the Eurozone, probably with Greece leaving this year. But I now have to accept that I've been wrong about that, because I have totally underestimated the complete fanaticism, Mr. Barroso, of you, your College of Commissioners, and the European Central Bank. You've come out fighting on all fronts. Today you announced there's going to be a banking union, yet more centralised control, yet more regulation. You make it clear that whilst you think the nation state should continue to exist, it mustn't have any democratic powers. All democracy is to be vested here under what you call the community method, which of course means that your unelected commission has the sole right to present that legislation. So I don't believe you when you say that, and I find the tone of much of what has been said and done over the last few days really very worrying. Mario Draghi, now known by some that believe in the Euro as Super Mario, well, he showed us his big bazooka the other day. He upped the stakes. He told us, and it's to me an odd concept, that he had unlimited money. Now, I don't think money grows on trees, and I think that money is limited to what the German, Dutch and Finnish taxpayers are prepared to put in. But he's made it clear his intention. He will fight to the last German taxpayer to keep the Mediterranean countries that should never have joined the euro in there. And you've got, of course, the Prime Minister now of Italy, perhaps we ought to call him Monstrous Mario, who made it clear last week that he feared that nation-state democracy could bring down the European Union, and therefore we have to bypass nation-state democracy and pass all the powers here. Your henchman, Olli Rehn, who's here today, I mean, he dares to tell countries when they should and should not have general elections. He's urging Spain to accept a full bailout so that they too are trapped in the euro prison. You know, I have to accept that you now have the whip hand over the citizens of Europe, and I now think that this euro crisis will go on for a whole miserable decade. In the end, you will have to face the reality that even France and Germany cannot survive together in the same economic and monetary union. And certainly with President Hollande reducing retirement ages, upping minimum wages, and bringing in a hate tax for the successful, which will see all the entrepreneurs leave France, I'm afraid that gap will get bigger. And I wonder where the hope comes for those that believe in nation-state democracy. Well, we've heard that the German court this morning has decided that the ESM is okay. Maybe the Finns will say they've had enough. Maybe the Germans, as a country, will say we no longer are going to go on feeling ashamed and guilty of what our grandparents' generation did, and we'll start to stand up for our own economic interests. I don't know, but I suspect that the best hope we've got actually comes from the United Kingdom, where now the demand for a referendum is stronger than it's ever been, where a Conservative Prime Minister is in very deep trouble. And I think, Mr. Barroso, today, the British people hearing you calling for the European Union to become a global power, making it absolutely clear that member states must obey what you tell them, whether they're in the relatively wealthy north or the poorer south. I think those comments, this emerging, creeping euro dictatorship, is something that will repulse millions of British people. And the only good news I take from today is you've helped to bring that referendum just a little bit closer.
So can you see, brethren and sisters and young people, Bible prophecy being fulfilled? God chooses his workmen very carefully, doesn't he? And that man's been working away for 15 years now. They tried probably to assassinate him and to get rid of him in a number of ways, not successful. And because God wants that man there for a purpose, it's clear. And so Britain will come out of the EU. It will not be part of Europe at the time of Armageddon. I find that fascinating, and I find that particularly helpful when you see other things happening, just how close we are to the return of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, just one final word on Britain and her allies. Here's Ezekiel 38, verse 13, with which we're quite familiar. Sheba, Dedan, merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof. And we have here a First World War poster, which sets out who those young lions were. America had to be dragged into the First World War. You know, you might not be aware of the fact that Winston Churchill was the Lord of the Admiralty in 1916, actually arranged for the sinking of the Lusitania, the American liner, which was half stacked with high explosives. The German spies in New York knew that. They actually tried to publish newspaper articles to warn American citizens, and there were 195 of them or something, who got on the Lusitania, paid big money for it to go to Britain. And the Germans tried to publish these articles, and most newspapers wouldn't publish them, to warn people not to get on it. They were given one destroyer as an escort, and when they got near Ireland, the British knew that there was a U-boat there because a British ship had been sunk the day before. The Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, got on the blower and called the destroyer off, sent the destroyer home, and the Lusitania sailed into this area where the U-boat was. A torpedo was fired, it blew up, and 190-odd American citizens were killed, and that's what dragged America into the war. You know why that had to be done? Well, Britain was about to ask Germany for armistice terms. They were so poverty-stricken, they were nearly bankrupt. They were about to ask Germany in 1916 for armistice terms. And so the only way to get America into the war was to blow up an American ship with American citizens on it. That's how politics was played in those days, desperate politics. And, of course, we know what happened in the Second World War. The Americans were not interested. You know, the Japanese had to bomb Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December 1941 before America came into the war. So America was not really a strong supporter of Britain in either of the wars until they were forced to be so. It was these countries, Australia, Canada, India and New Zealand, that are the true young lions. Helped by the young lions, the old lion defies his foes. And among the countries who survived the global financial crisis of 2008, the best were, you got it, Australia, Canada, India and New Zealand. There were a few others as well. But that they were the ones who were amongst the best survivors of the GFC and are doing much better now than, of course, America is, as we know. Well, there's a reason for that too, as you can see. Now, I want to turn to the papacy. This man, Pope Francis I, was elected, of course, in March 2013. He was 76 years of age. He's been living on one lung for 20 years, but he's put there for a purpose, I believe, by God. Now, I'm not going to go into all the details, but he's actually called a black pope because he's the first Jesuit to ever be elected pope. Jesuits are not elected popes. You know why? Well, because they come from the lower order of the priests. They were the stormtroopers of the Catholic Church, especially in the times of great persecution like the Inquisition. It was the Jesuits who were the murderers of the opposition to the Church. And so, you know, they had their hands dirty. So popes were normally elected from people who had relatively clean hands, so to speak. Well, this man is the first Jesuit to be elected a pope. And, of course, he presents himself as a man of the people, a man of the, you know, the lower order. And we're going to see a little bit about his background in a moment. That's all I want to say about that. But one brother up in Canada, when he was elected, came to me and said, you know, this, you're always talking about 13 being the number of rebellion and that Nimrod's the 13th generation from Adam. He said, did you realise that the Roman Catholic Church picked a new pope on the 13th of the 3rd of 13? Now, this is not done in the American way. If it was American, it would be 3-13-13, okay? As the date is written at the Vatican, and 7:06 p.m., and 7 plus 6, of course, is also 13. Well, you know, there's nothing to that, brothers and sisters, but 13 does happen to be the number of Nimrod, the number of rebellion, and Nimrod was the first pope, so I found that sort of curious. So here is Nimrod's visage, the only visage that they've ever found that they can actually identify as Nimrod, and he happens to be Negroid in features. Now, he's a dark-skinned man. Of course, he comes from Ham, a descendant of Ham, who was, of course, the father of the dark races. Now, I believe, and you've heard me say this before, that whether it's the Pope at Armageddon or the last Pope in 2060, I don't know, but one of them is going to be a black man. Now, in the last election for the papacy in March 2013, there was a black man from Nigeria who almost got up. He was the favourite. So the day will come when there will be a black pope. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because the first pope was black. Yeah, here he is. There's his face, Nimrod. He was the first god king of the earth, the first man worshipped as a god and a king. He was the founder, using the doctrines of his father Cush, of the Roman Catholic system, Babylon. And Cush wrote the Catechism of the Catholic Church. So this man was the first pope, so to speak, first father king. Nimrod, of course, was the 13th generation from Adam, and he established the kingdom of men. So I don't think there's any doubt that there will, in due course, be a black pope, probably the last one. That's the way God works, isn't it? So what about this man who became pope last year? Well, he called himself Pope Francis I. It's the first time that that name has been used in history, the first time that a Jesuit has been made pope. Why? Why do you think he called himself Francis I? Well, his hero is Francis of Assisi. If you know anything about Francis of Assisi, he was a man, Catholic of course, very much a man of the people. And that's what this pope wanted to be, a man of the people. But I also think there's a more subtle reason. The last emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was Francis II. You can see his picture there. Now, he was defeated in the Battle of Austerlitz on the 2nd of December, 1805, by Napoleon. Napoleon only had 66,000 men. The Austrians and Russians, with a combined army of over 100,000 men, were defeated by Napoleon in one of the most brilliant battles in history. And when that battle occurred, Napoleon wrote to Francis II, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and said, "You're done, mate. You don't abdicate. I'm coming to Vienna." So in 1806, he abdicated. He sat down under compulsion and wrote a letter abdicating his rulership of the Holy Roman Empire. It came to an end. That's Bible prophecy. We know that from Revelation 16. Okay? And he went back to be called Francis I of Austria. All right? And 6 or 7 years later, he was given most of his territories back when they defeated Napoleon, when the Allies defeated Napoleon in 1814. You know, that's what Europe's trying to do today. They're trying to rebuild the Holy Roman Empire, which came to an end in 1806. They've had three goes already. There was 1870, the Second Reich, failed. There was 1930s and 40s, the Third Reich, Hitler, failed. He wanted to last as long as the First Reich, 1,000 years, failed. Now they're doing the fourth one. They're rebuilding the Holy Roman Empire again. The Fourth Reich. And it will not come into existence until after the return of Christ, because that will be the empire that Christ and the saints destroy in 2060. So I think there are reasons, very good reasons, why this man called himself Francis I. And as I said, he's presenting himself as this caring, sort of like grandfather figure. So he appears to be liberal-minded and a caring figure, a man of the people, but in actual fact, he's rock-solid iron. What he's doing is very cunning indeed. He's duped the world, for a start. Now, he's recently given hope to homosexuals that they have a place in the Roman Catholic Church. In November 2013, he began a worldwide consultation of Catholic dioceses, including questions in that of pastoral care for same-sex couples and remarried divorcees. Now, the Roman Catholic Church has got clear, rock-solid doctrines about that. And you know, in the 20-odd year reign of Pope John Paul II, the man who was in charge of doctrine in the Catholic Church was Cardinal Ratzinger, who became in 2005 Pope Benedict XVI, who's just stood aside. Why? Well, because the Catholic Church that went through that chaotic period in the 1960s, when liberalism was beginning to take over, wanted to get back and to become the iron that the Scripture says it would be at the end of the days. Rock solid doctrine. We will not budge from this. Pity our brotherhood's not quite the same, eh? But we believe in that. We're not going to move from it. Well, that's what they're like. Now, this guy appears to be different. He's not. He's not going to change one iota of Catholic doctrine and practice, but he is going to present a gentle, caring, apparently liberal face to the world. And that's what he's doing. And I'm going to show you in a moment, I believe that's fulfilling Bible prophecy. Francis has called for church reform and for Catholics to do more about poverty. He seeks closer relations with other religions, is moving to do what John Paul II didn't ever achieve, and that is to repair the Catholic Church's relationship with the Russian Orthodox Church. And in November 2013, he called for closer ties with Islam. Come on, this is Catholicism and Islam. Poles apart. And said that Christians should embrace Muslim immigrants with affection and respect. And he met Vladimir Putin, of course, on the 25th of November, and you might have seen pictures of Putin presenting him with an image of Mary of Vladimir, which is interesting given his name, and he was kissing this icon of the Russian Orthodox Church in the presence of the Pope, and Pope said he was very happy to receive it. So things are happening, and that's why Time magazine made him the Time Person of the Year for 2013. Now, the Time Person of the Year is not about virtue. You don't have to be virtuous to be made Person of the Year, because you see, the runners-up were Edward Snowden, leaking American secrets to the world, and Bashar al-Assad, murdering hundreds of thousands of his own people. So you don't have to be virtuous to become the person of the year. You just need to be influential. And that's what Pope Francis I has been. In less than 12 months since he was elected, he gets where John Paul didn't even get, on the front of the Time magazine. So what's going on here? Well, the Time website said this about the reasons why they selected him. See, there are significant shifts in the church, they think. John Paul II and Benedict XVI were professors of theology. Francis is a former janitor. You know, that's the one who cleans up the dirt on the floor. A nightclub bouncer. Huh? Yeah, he's a Jesuit. Chemical technician and literature teacher. And behind his self-effacing facade, he is a very canny operator. I can agree with that one. He makes masterly use of the 21st century tools to perform his first century office. Well, I don't agree with that particular statement. But what makes this Pope so important is the speed with which he has captured the imaginations of millions who had given up on hoping for the church at all. You know, I heard just a few weeks ago, people being interviewed in the streets of Rome on the BBC or something like that. And they were asking these people questions. You know, when Pope Benedict XVI used to give speeches on the radio, did you listen to him? 100% said no. Then they asked the question, when Pope Francis I gives radio speeches, do you listen? 100% said yes. That's the change that's occurred. People are now listening to this man. He is quoted saying of women who consider abortion because of poverty or rape, who can remain unmoved before such painful situations? Of gay people, if a homosexual person is of good will and is in search of God, I am no one to judge. Now, think about what he's saying. He's not saying the Catholic Church approves it, is he? He's just pulling the door a little bit, you know, and he's giving the appearance that they're going to accept. They're not going to accept that. They're not going to change their doctrine or their practice, but they're presenting themselves as though they will. To divorced and remarried Catholics who are by rule forbidden from taking communion, he says that this crucial rite is not a prize for the perfect, but a powerful medicine and nourishment for the weak. So this is the man. I want you to come to Daniel 2. Daniel chapter 2. Now, had we done a reading, it would have been this section in Daniel. Daniel 2, 31 to 45. But I only want two verses out of this. And you've got them on the screen there. Verse 41 and verse 43. This is the prophecy, brothers and sisters and young people, that I believe we're actually watching fulfilled right now. I want to show you why. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 41, we read about the feet. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron. Forasmuch as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. So who does the iron represent? Well, of course, we know that iron was the symbol of the Roman Empire. Now, this is clearly about the latter days because the feet, as Brother Thomas said in the exposition of Daniel 18:54, in his day, the feet were not formed. But they are being formed now, 150 years later. We're watching the feet being formed. So we know we're in this era of time. So who would be the iron, do you think? Well, there's no Roman Empire today. That's got to be reformed at some stage by Russia. There's no Roman Empire. The iron is what remains of the Roman Empire, namely its religion, Roman Catholicism. That's the iron here. So who's the clay? Well, the clay represents ordinary common people, you know, the democratic republican systems, especially, of course, in Europe. Now, with that as a background, did you notice that there was a word mixed at the end of verse 41? Well, watch the green on the screen when I read verse 43. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. But they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Yes? Every one of those green words there, green coloured words, is the same Hebrew Chaldee word, garaf. It means to co-mingle. But with the root idea of braiding or intermixing something, and then by extension to traffic, as if by bartering. Also, it has the idea of being security, the idea of a guarantor. It's actually translated that way, be surety, in Genesis chapter 44 and verse 32 and in the Proverbs. So what we have here is God looking down upon the influence of Catholicism in the very last days before Armageddon. This is what was going to happen. Now, historically, we know what happened. Historically, it was the barbarians, the clay peoples, that mingled themselves with the iron. True? So in the 3rd, 4th and 5th centuries, all these barbarian peoples from east, north and west came down and they took their part of the Roman Empire and made their own little kingdoms on it. So it was clay that mingled with the iron. That's not what this is about. Did you read verse 43 carefully? Whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they, the iron, shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. This is about Catholicism mingling itself with the democratic peoples of Europe. And that's what's happening right now. We're watching Pope Francis I, living on one lung, put there by God to fulfill Bible prophecy. That's what I believe is happening right now. And that, he's been very effective, hasn't he? Not even in power for 9 months, and they make him person of the year. So things, big things are happening, brethren and sisters and young people, that are very relevant to you and me. The feet are in the process of being formed. Now, has our community understood this correctly? Yes. We can be very thankful for writings such as Henry Sully in the Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy, because this is what he says in the appendix to that book. In the second chapter of Daniel, the kingdoms of men are represented by a composite image consisting of four principal elements: first gold, second silver, third brass, and fourth iron. Each element representing some phase of the kingdoms of men. The fourth element, in its latter-day phase, assumes the aspect of clay and iron mixed, that is, republicanism and autocracy, shown perhaps in one of its most subtle aspects, notice this, its most subtle aspects, in the silent capture of democracy, read clay, by autocratic ecclesiasticism, read iron. Got it? Enabling the latter, the iron, to ride into power thereby. He got it exactly right. And that was 100 years ago. Exactly right. Because he understood Bible prophecy, read his Bible carefully. Right, now, that's actually happening. Brother Sully didn't see that. But we are watching it happen. We've got the iron of Catholicism using subtlety to mingle itself with the democratic powers of Europe so that you can have this brittle fusion. I mean, these things don't mix, do they? Autocracy, dictatorship, they don't mix with democracy where people elect their representatives. They are totally mutually exclusive, are they not? That's why it's going to break up pretty simply when the stone bough hits it, right? Because it will be a brittle fusion for a time. It's not going to last very long. But it'll last long enough for the image to stand up in the land of Israel and to be bowled over by the stone power of Christ and the saints. Got a picture? Yeah. We're watching Bible prophecy fulfilled as the European nations set about the task of redeveloping the Holy Roman Empire all over again. That's why some of the coins in Europe, the French coin, for example, has the visage of Charlemagne. You can see M-A-G-N, Charles the Great. You know what dates on the other side? 814 was the year he died. On the other side was the year that he became the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, 800 AD. He'd been king in France for decades. But the Europeans know that the vital date for them was 800 AD. And it's a very vital date for us, brethren and sisters. So in the last 10 minutes or so of our talk this morning, I want to just focus on the destiny of this system. So here we have the pattern of Roman Catholic resistance to Christ's rule for 40 years after Armageddon. We have Armageddon, of course, which is going to be a huge blow to them. But in the 10 years after Armageddon, Psalm 2 tells us they will rebuild their power. New Pope, if they needed one, new pope. They will rebuild their power. And then 10 years after Armageddon, Revelation 14 verse 8 says that Rome as a city will be destroyed. So the pope happens to be there in the Vatican. Goodbye. Ta-da. Gurgler. Right? He's gone. Stop him? No. Well, big blow. But they'll resort to Central Europe. And of course, it was in Central Europe that Charlemagne ruled. So that's when the Holy Roman Empire will come into existence. As Brother Thomas correctly points out, this period here of Armageddon, up to the destruction of Rome, that's the revival of the beast of the sea, when the papacy has political power. But it will not be until here that we'll see the revival of the beast of the earth, where you have an emperor and a pope, two horned beast, Revelation 13 verse 8. And the power that Christ and the saints will destroy up here in 2060 will be the revived Holy Roman Empire, the Fourth Reich. And it will be destroyed in 2060. You know, Sir Isaac Newton understood that, didn't he? He was the foremost mathematician, physicist, probably one of the greatest minds in history. He had a good understanding of the Bible. He probably came pretty close to the truth. But he could never get out of his situation because he was locked in by the church. It was savage in those days against any miscreants that wanted to jump out of their ranks. And he had too big a job. You know, he was a very popular man. He lived between 1642 and 1727. He wrote on religion, he rejected the Trinity as unscriptural, and he predicted 2060 as the year of the demise of the papacy. Now, think about that. He predicted 2060 in the early years of the 1700s. All right? How'd he do that? Well, he read his Bible correctly. He got this one right. You know, his private papers were kept secret for fear of the church. The note in the margin of his Bible of this 2060 demise of the papacy has actually been seen by a Christadelphian, who was an expert on Sir Isaac Newton and teaches that in the University of Halifax. All right, so he's actually seen the Bible. It's there. Now, why? Well, we're in Daniel, I think, aren't you? Have a look at Daniel 7. Now, I'd love to have time to sort of circle around this a bit, but we're going to focus just on the one verse, verse 8. It's up there on the screen, and I'd like you to have a look at what this verse is all about. This is about the development of the Holy Roman Empire, which happened in 800 AD. This is how it came about. There were 10 horns formed on the body, the head of the Roman Empire by the barbarian invasions. At least 10 barbarian powers. And that's how the scripture presents it. So there were 10 nations who came in like they were the clay mingling with iron, became part of the Roman Empire, adopted many of its religion and rules and laws eventually. So what happened in history was this. It says here that three of the first of the 10 horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn, this little horn which rises up in place of the three, were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. Now, of course, they call the papacy the Holy See. He's got priests everywhere watching you. And, of course, the Pope issues what they call encyclicals. Encyclicals, you know, this is the doctrine of the Catholic Church that comes from the papacy, who from 1870 declared himself to be infallible when speaking ex cathedra. Well, of course, there are encyclicals that contradict each other, so I'm not sure about the infallibility. So, we've got an encyclical mouth issuing decrees and changing dates and times. Now, what happened in history was this. The papacy eventually fell out with the Roman emperors who were installed from 324 AD in Constantinople. In the late 600 ADs and the early 700s, the Eastern Emperor decided that they were going to forsake the worship of idols. And he asked the Pope, he said, we're going to give away our idols. We want you to give up your idols. And he said, go and jump in the lake. To which they replied, well, you can row your own canoe. We're not going to look after you anymore. No funding, no armies to protect you. You're on your own. I'm saying, okay, I'm not giving up my idols. So what happened was that in time, there were three Lombard kingdoms that had been established in northern Italy, and they said, "You beauty, he's got no protection from the east anymore. Let's go and make life hard for him." So they did, for decades. He got sick of it. And in the end, he called upon Pepin, the king of France, who happened to be the father of Charlemagne, by the way. And Pepin came down, and in several campaigns from 754 to 758 AD, he battled with these Lombard states, he conquered them, and he gave them to the Pope, who immediately created a triple tiara crown. Yeah, the three horns plucked up. He's given these three kingdoms. This is Pope Pius XII, the Second World War Pope, who was in league with Hitler, right, wearing the triple tiara crown. That was 758. But it was not until 800 AD that Charlemagne was crowned emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. He's the son of Pepin. He took over from Pepin when Pepin died and ruled in France. But in 800 AD, he was made the emperor of this new empire. It's the little horn that would grow up with eyes and a mouth. Right? Got the history pretty squared away. Most of you are familiar with it anyway. Let's have a look at the interpretation. Daniel 7, this is 23 to 26. We haven't got time to read all of this. So let me just focus in on the important stuff here. There's the interpretation of what happened in history, or would happen in history. There's the business about the eyes and mouth. And then it says that that they shall be given into his hand until a time, times, and the dividing of time. But the judgment would come, he would lose his dominion, and the saints would take it over. Now it's that phrase, time, times, and a dividing of time, we need to focus on for a few minutes, or a couple of minutes. You know what that means, don't we? A Jewish time is a year, and a Jewish year was 360 days, unlike our 365. That's why the Jews got to catch up every few years with a 13th month. So here we've got a Jewish year, 360 days, and on the day for a year principle, it represents 360 years. So you've got one time, that's 360. Times is 2 by 360, that's 720. And a dividing, if you divide it down the middle, is half of 360, that's 180. So when you add that up, 360, 720 plus 180, you come to 1260. 1260 years, of course, is a common number in our Bibles, very common. You know, the 3.5 years of the drought and the times of Elijah that's picked up in Revelation 11. You got the 3.5 year ministry of John the Baptist, the 3.5 ministry of Christ, 1260. So it's a very, very common time period. Now, does it work? Yes, it works. I mean, the calendar we're using here is the Gregorian calendar, which is as wonky as the Catholic system. It was developed by Pope Gregory the 13th. But providing you stay in it, you're fine. Stay in the calendar. It's fine. From 312, which was when Constantine came to power and gave to the church that had supported him, the apostate Christian church, the guarantee that he would help them and support them to persecute and oppress their internal enemies, our brethren, many of them. All right. From the time that that persecution of the witnesses began until effective witnessing against the Catholic system came to an end in 1572, the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day, was exactly 1,260 years. That woke you up, didn't it? Sorry. You weren't asleep anyway, she was writing. So here we've got 1260. What about the next one? From 529 to 533, Justinian wrote decrees giving the Bishop of Rome political power in the West and headship of the church. When did that come to an end, effectively, in the West? Well, in 1789 to 1793, exactly 1,260 years. You add 1260 to 529, you get 1789. That was the beginning of the French Revolution. What was the height of the French Revolution, by which time the Catholic system had been destroyed in France? Well, 1793, yeah, exactly 1,260 years after 533. So what was given by Justinian was taken away by the French Revolution, exactly 1,260 years later. In 608 and 610, this grubby little centurion called Phocas became the emperor And God put him there. Clearly, he shouldn't have been emperor, but he was. He gave a decree, giving the papacy what they call temporal power. Temporal power is political power over land and people. Now he was like a king in his own right. Well, exactly 1260 years later, in 1868, Garibaldi came up from Naples and pushed the Pope out of Rome, and by 1870, he'd lost all his temporal power. It's never failed. And I can tell you, brothers and sisters and young people, you can, if you find in history any accretion of papal power, just add 1260 to it, and that will be the terminus. What does that mean for you and me? Well, two important dates here, 758, 800. Let's add our 1260, shall we? You add 1260 to 758, you come to 2018. That's when the papacy, I believe, will reacquire political power in Europe. And that'll come on the back of the greatest depression in human history, when those European nations will be absolutely dependent on papal support. You add 1260 to 800, you come to 2060. And of course we know that date is not that far away. Now, I haven't got time. I'm watching the hand of that clock. I haven't got time to go through that chart. Some of you have seen it before. I want to come to this to finish this morning. So we ask the question, how long, O Lord? We know there's 50 years from the resurrection to the time that Christ walks his bride around a completed house. That can be shown quite clearly from Ezekiel. We know that therefore, because there's a 40-year judgment period, that there's a 10-year period between the resurrection and Armageddon. So how long have we got? Well, we can be confident that the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire that supports it will be destroyed in 2060. However, if you have a look at Revelation chapter 19, verses 20 and 21, verse 21 tells you that while the papacy and the empire or the beast that supports it will be destroyed, that doesn't mean that all the adherents of Catholicism are destroyed at that time. There is a period in which it says, and the remnant that supported the papacy have to be cleaned up. Now, how long will that be? Well, it's at least going to be 3 years, 4 years, at least. At least. Because you're working on this 50-year scale, it's got to be at least 4 years. Because that's telling us something very important. The length of that period will determine how long we have. If it happens to be 4 years, Christ will come in 2014. If it happens to be 5 years, he'll come in 2015. If it happens to be 6 years, it'll be 2016. And so on. How long do you think they can stop the coming depression? Not long, I would have thought. Not long. You make up your own mind where that's leading us.